Lean Leadership Podcast, episode 69.
This is the Lean Leadership Podcast. Equip yourself with the tools for success in your team's lean journey by learning from the world's top lean professionals. Listen at the risk of improving with your host, Chris Burnham.
Happy New Year. I hope your 2022 is filled with all the personal and professional success that you endeavor to achieve. I'm really excited about our first guest this year, Peter Docker. Peter is inspired by seeing others harness what makes each of us extraordinary as human beings. He enables people to shift the context around what they see as possible for themselves and their team. Often, the greatest thing in our way is ourselves. A keynote speaker and facilitator, he presents around the world, having delivered workshops and bespoke leadership programs to audiences ranging from 20 to 3,000 people. He also stages high-quality online virtual events using professional television studios and his production team. Peter is the author of Leading from the Jump Seat, How to Create Extraordinary Opportunities by Handing Over Control, and he is also the co-author of Find Your Why, a practical guide for discovering purpose for you and your team with Simon Sinek and David Mead. Here's our guest today, Peter Docker. Well, Peter, thank you for being with us today. We briefly touched on who you were in the intro, but can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, what you do, and how leadership is a part of your life?
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for having me on your show. So I'm Peter. Good heavens, it's almost my 59th birthday. So early next year. So in those 59 years, I've been so fortunate with the different opportunities and things I've done in the world. I started off, I guess my main career was in the Royal Air Force. I served for 25 years in the British Royal Air Force. I was a pilot, but also I did many other things. I led people during combat, which was a big leadership experience for me. I taught at the Defence College on leadership, the British Defence College. I ran multi-billion dollar programs for equipment and procurement. I negotiated with the Russians on behalf of NATO when the Berlin Wall came down. Negotiated with your Secretary of State Department for export licensing, so many different things. So that was my first 25 years, if you like. And then I left and joined a consultancy working in high-risk industries such as oil and gas, mining, construction, where people tended to get killed or injured. And we helped them lead and create cultures where everyone went home safe every day. And that took me to the places such as the Middle East, to Kazakhstan, to Africa, all over. And then after about 3 years, I stepped away from that and I started working with Simon Sinek, who many will have heard of. And I was what was termed at the time one of the founding igniters. And I spent 8 years with Simon, helping him take his message around the world. And I visited 93 countries. I've worked with hundreds of organizations in practically every industry you can imagine. And that's been a joy. But in December 2019, myself and the other co-author of Find Your Why that we wrote with Simon, David Mead, we stepped away to develop other opportunities. And over the last year or so, I focused on bringing everything I've learned through all of those experiences together in my new book called Leading from the Jump Seat. So that's where I am now in my potted history.
Well, Peter, I am in Memphis, Tennessee. Can you share with our listeners where you are this evening?
Yes, for me, it's dark outside. It's evening. As you might be able to tell from the accent, I'm from England. I live just west of the city of Oxford, known for its universities. I'm talking to you from my studio, my family home. And yes, it's Friday night now, but it's a delight to spend that time with you, Chris, discussing all things leadership.
Well, I appreciate you joining us. We're definitely going to get into it, but Peter, I recently read your new book, Leading from the Jump Seat. It's got a little playful metaphor for folks familiar with aviation that we're going to dive into, but about leadership and life. But before we get started with the interview, I always ask our guests to share with us a quote or a mantra from one of their favorite leaders. So can you tell us what your quote is and why you chose it?
There are so many that I could have chosen. So I've gone with what first came into my mind, which is people will forget what you say, they'll forget what you do, but they'll remember how you made them feel. That's from Maya Angelou. And that has particular resonance for me because throughout my career, whether I've been leading people in a commercial sense or when their lives are on the line, what is so important is how people feel in the moment. Do they feel humbly confident? Do they feel timid? Do they feel afraid? And when you're in a role of leadership, we have an opportunity to influence how people feel for the better so as they can perform at their best. So that's why Maya Angelou's quote always resonates with me deeply.
I love how you chose that quote in it, and you talk about it in your book when you talk about feelings. And one of the things that stood out to me in the course of reading your book was the importance of self-awareness. So you need to understand how you feel first so you can put yourself in the right frame to be able to lead others. And you call that taking a stand for something. So can you talk about leadership and the importance of taking a stand and the energy that comes from that when you do it from a right place versus opposed from doing it in the wrong place?
Yeah, absolutely. This goes to the starting place of my book, actually, Chris, which is I think it's important for us to reflect what's really important to us as individuals. Before we start thinking of anybody else, what's really matters to us? I'm not talking about your latest iPhone or pay rise, whatever. I'm talking about deep down. And for many of us, family is important. You know, I had a call from my wife a couple of years ago. She'd just been involved in a traffic accident in her car. And I dropped everything. And I went to go and join my wife. It was only a couple of miles down the road. Now, what I find interesting about that is the energy it released inside of us. Although I was stepping into the unknown, there was nothing that would have stopped me or got in my way. Nothing. And that had me think, what if we identify those other things that are really deeply important to us? Because when we do, it gives us access to this reservoir of energy that helps move us forward, even when the challenges in front of us are unknown or huge or we haven't come across them before. And when we identify what those things are, they can turn into what I refer to as stands. And there's a difference between a stand and a position. We'd only need to open a newspaper or turn on the TV news today to hear a lot of people taking positions against things. Yeah, and that's what defines a position. It's against something or someone. But here's the thing. For a position to exist, there needs to be a counterposition. Yeah, it's like when two cars, we've got a narrow street by our house here, and there's only enough room for one car to pass at a time. And so you can have two cars meeting fender to fender or bumper to bumper, waiting for the other to give way. And, you know, they can take up a position against the other driver, saying things like, well, you are traveling too fast. You reverse up to the passing place. Or my journey is more important than yours. You back off. And those positions become more and more entrenched. But occasionally, you'll come across a driver who immediately reverses back to the passing place because they have got a stand. And that stand is for being courteous on the road. And here's the thing, like with any other stand, it's not dependent on anyone or anything else to exist. It's what we stand for. It's what we believe. And when we reverse up and allow that other driver to pass on by, that other driver's position immediately dissolves because there's no counterposition anymore. But our stand becomes stronger. So this is the process. When we identify what's really deeply important to us, and for me, yes, family's important, but also drivers such as mutual respect, such as not being a burden on others and being able to support other people. These are really deep down drivers for me, or stands. And that's what has me move forward when others might hesitate or stop, because it's the reserve of energy that helps me on my way. So that's the reason why stands are so important.
I think one of the things that stood out to me when I read the book, Peter, and I was reflecting is, when you take a stand, it gives you energy, but when you take a position, it robs you or consumes the energy that you would have otherwise.
Yeah, totally. And just briefly building on that, Chris, you know, we can get more fundamental on stands and positions. You know, everything that's important to us, everything that's important to us in life is driven by one of two things. It's driven either by fear or love. Now, whenever I mention love in a business context, people tend to get a bit twitchy, but we'll come back to that. in a moment. Let's look at fear. When we're driven by fear, several things happen. You know, fear can be triggered when our life is threatened, and that's good. You know, if we step out into the street and a car's coming, we hop back and it saves our life. But more importantly, fear is triggered when we sense our livelihood, our status, or our reputation is under threat. And when it's triggered by those three things, often fear does not help us. It gets in the way. It shows up as perhaps anger or the other extreme, timidity, or the big one, it shows up as ego. And when we are driven by fear and that leads to ego, we just think about ourselves. It's Greek for I anyway, ego. We just think and focus on ourselves. We stop thinking about others. We start seeing the world as a place of scarcity and a binary win-lose, and we got to win and everybody else has got to lose. And it is draining. And also, it doesn't get us very far.
No,
but we always have a choice. No, it doesn't, does it? But we always have a choice. And that choice is to choose to be driven instead by love. Now, love is not about rushing around hugging trees necessarily or anything like that. Love is a powerful driving force, more powerful than fear. It's more sustainable than fear. What love looks like in a business context is that we continue to think about others and serving others. We see the world as a place of opportunity and possibility rather than fear and scarcity. And instead of ego, we allow ourselves to be driven by humble confidence. And humble confidence is the phrase I use to define or to describe us being absolutely resolute on where we're heading and ready and able to take decisions when they need to be taken. But importantly, being willing to listen to others and to engage in, well, accessing the, what I call the collective genius of our team. And it takes a humility to do that. So this is what we access when we are driven by love. And it links to that position and stand thing, because positions are generally based out of fear. But stands come up from a place of love for something. And what joins it all together is something called courage. Courage can't exist without fear, but courage can only be sustained by love. And that is a hugely generative thing that takes us forward.
Yeah, I think that makes complete sense, because sometimes people confuse courage for an absence of fear, but it's the conquering of fear with something that's stronger on the other side of it. And I love that you mentioned humble confidence. I think people familiar with lean or continuous improvement principles will understand and see that it'll resonate with them from a standpoint of humble inquiry, where it's not about me, it's about you. I want to learn what is the problem from your perspective? What is the challenge from your perspective?
Yeah.
And the best leaders that I've ever been around, they didn't tell things. They asked really good, insightful questions.
Yeah.
And as you talked about, I recognize that now it's an absence of ego. It is that humble confidence of, hey, I'm here to ask the right questions, and that's my role. So yeah. I love that. It's just the folks with, we talked in the pre-conversation about, hey, there was a lot when I read about lean and continuous improvement that resonated with the work that I've done, and it all comes to roost, yeah, so to speak, here.
Absolutely. And that humility is so important. It's not about being meek or timid, but it's about, well, here's the thing, you know, if we always have to be the person, as a senior person, if we always have to be the guy or the girl who has the answer, we become the constriction in the pipe, because our team can only move as quickly as we know the answer to the challenges we face. But when we develop the strength to lead when we don't know the answer, and instead we frame the important questions, then we invite others in from our team who together we can learn our way through to the solution. That's when our team accelerates. That's when we get velocity. In other words, speed and direction. And we're no longer the constriction of the pipe. But it means that we have to put ego to bed, and we have to instead choose love and humble confidence to act as a driver to take us forward.
Well, Peter, one of my goals for this podcast is to help other leaders resonate with your experiences. So can you share with us a story about how or why you chose to devote your profession to the development of other leaders?
Well, that's an interesting question because as you ask it, I'm trying to think back. What was the point in my life when I decided that? I don't think there was a specific point, Chris. I think it came from, more than anything, a desire to share what I've learned. As I mentioned in the intro, you know, I've been so fortunate having all these different experiences. And to the listener, it might sound, wow, these are all very high-profile things. Well, I'll let you into a secret. Most of the time, I felt completely out of my depth with all of those things. You know, we hear a lot about imposter syndrome. Boy, I have that puppy right on my shoulder. I felt inadequate doing a lot of those jobs. I always thought, Guy, why have they got me in here? There are so many other people who would be better. But that was because I was working on the edge of my comfort zone. And although I didn't necessarily recognize it or appreciate it at the time, that gave me the opportunity to grow as a person and reach further. And so I think where I am now in life, I've got the opportunity to share that with others. And writing the book has been an example of that. You know, bring it all together in hopefully a pretty coherent form that makes sense for folks, whether they are leading a small team, they're a CEO of a major global organization, or to be honest, as a parent. Because you know what? Bringing up kids that are two now in their late 20s and one's 30, they have left home and they are leading their own lives. And I think for many of us, one of the biggest challenges in leadership is leading as a parent. Because we want to lift our kids up, don't we? And from what I know about lean, that's all about lean in effect. It's about growing new leaders. And we want our kids to be able to lead their own lives confidently, with humble confidence. We want them to carry forward those things that we feel are important as well in terms of what we might call our drives or our values. So there are quite a few stories in the book which relate to experiences I've had, challenges I've had as a parent, because it applies in that situation just as much as it does in the boardroom, in my view, and be able to tie it all together and find the commonalities between these situations, I think is in service of others. So I've just fallen into this, I think, of helping others to lead.
I somehow in my heart, I believe that when you take a stand for the right things, that the right opportunities open themselves up and that you're attracted to those. One of the things that stood out to me about the book is that you talk about everyone has agency to be a leader. Like, you don't have to wait until somebody gives you a title or a role that we choose to be a leader when we choose to help others. And can you expand upon that a little bit?
Yeah, and I'd say the starting point for leadership is leading yourself. And well, for quite a few people, one of the early opportunities to lead oneself is when you choose to go to college or university, or choose not to, you know. Because what generally happens then, say you're going to go off, you can say, right, I'm going to study computing. There will be people out there say, oh, I don't know whether you want to go in that direction. Have you thought of marketing instead? You know, or if you choose not to go to university, and people say, oh, well, you're missing the opportunity there. But this is the first time we will have the opportunity to lead, perhaps, where we're choosing to do something because it feels right to us. And there will be the naysayers out there, but we continue down that path because it feels right to us. We make a commitment. And a commitment, actually, some people think that commitments are to do about with contracts or commitments we make to others. But actually, none of that counts without the promise to ourselves. A commitment is a promise that we make to ourselves to carry forward an idea or work through a challenge. And that is an example of that is when we first go to college or university, for example. You know, and that's when we begin to lead ourselves and when we figure out what's truly deeply important to us. And the more we practice that, the more consistent we become and the better we become leading ourselves. And then that sets us up to lead others as we move forward in life.
Peter, one of the things that stands out to me is that you've had this remarkable career journey so far, where you have you've been an accomplished aviator. You have flown the Prime Minister of Great Britain. You have survived combat. You've led others in combat and brought your entire squadron home safely. You've been around remarkable leaders your entire career, and you've had a pretty good distinguished track record for leadership. But I have to imagine that it wasn't always successes and accolades. There had to be some moments where you had setbacks with leadership, or as upon reflection, you feel like maybe you didn't make the best choice. Can you share with us maybe what you consider your biggest setback with leadership and what you learned from that moment?
Well, I think the second point you made there, Chris, is so important. It's what you learn, you know? And I share a story in the book, actually, of what is probably right up there with one of my errors, maybe. I say maybe because I did learn a lot from it. And that is when I first took over my squadron. And for those who don't know, a squadron in the Air Force, most Air Forces, it is the fighting unit. It's the basic fighting unit of the military. And to be given a squadron to command is a huge privilege. And the chap I took over from was a wonderful commanding officer. His name was Ian. He's hugely capable as an aviator. He seemed to have wonderful charisma. Everybody seemed to love him. And I thought, how on earth am I going to match that? You know, I felt inadequate in many, many ways, because everything I saw that was great in Ian, I perceived I did not have. And so I remember very clearly that for the first few months, I was trying subconsciously to be Ian, to be my predecessor, because who he had been, well, that worked for him. Why wouldn't it work for me? And of course it didn't, because people, they felt that it wasn't right. I wasn't being the person that they previously knew. It wasn't authentic. It wasn't real. And so what that meant is that they didn't know how to relate to me. And what that meant is that they didn't trust me. And I guess it must have been about 6 months into my tour as a commanding officer that the penny finally dropped. You know, I just need to be myself. And once I relaxed into that, then I built those relationships and we started to rebuild trust, and things started to go much better. So I learned a lot from that mistake, as we might call it.
Well, no, but that raises a really good question, because I think that a lot of people in their career journeys, they shift from a space where they are just, like in your example, you were an accomplished aviator. You were an instructor. You're teaching other aviators. And then you move to a role of leadership where now you're responsible for things that are around the aircraft, like ordnance, engineering, yeah, maintenance, supply, facilities. Mm. But those things, being in a cockpit and understanding how to solve problems in the cockpit, at the same time that they prepare you for decisions outside the cockpit, they also don't necessarily enable you for the new things that challenges you're gonna get. Because now you're responsible for holding space for others to be great, not in a cockpit. Can you talk about the transition there, about how you, yeah, I mean, you talk about imposter syndrome, but you had to learn. It wasn't given to you. You had other examples, but you had to learn yourself along the way, right?
You're right. I think I was lucky in the sense that flying an aircraft, I flew big aircraft, air refuelers at the time. So we gave away gas to fighter jets in the air. So we were totally undefended, unarmed. You know, it wasn't the fancy, sexy thing with lots of machine guns or whatever. No, we flew around, and often we get shot at from the ground, which got a bit irritating. But, you know, that was our job. But I think the whole process of flying an aeroplane, you can't do it alone. You know, there are dozens and dozens of people who contribute to getting that aeroplane airborne. And so I think it becomes part of our culture and outlook right from the early days when we first start flying, that we have to rely on others to do their job. And we get used to asking others for their input when they are the expert in the field and we are not. Yeah. Now, importantly, that really prepared me later on, because my final job in the Royal Air Force before leaving was running this $20 billion program, which is all about procuring new aircraft, services, communications, IT, a whole range of aspects to this project. And I ran a team that had lots of experts in fields that I knew nothing about. I had legal experts, commercial experts. And so it was a big step up for me there, but I had some background in how to lead when you don't know all the answers. And instead, my role was to ask the important questions, to get the information from my experts, and then wrap it up in a form that was needed to move the project forward or to brief government ministers or whatever it happened to be. And I think I was very lucky that my earlier training of being a pilot helped me do that. But so often we don't get that training, and we suddenly find that in industry, we suddenly find that we go from being the expert computer programmer, for example, to now running a team taking care of the computer programmers, and we've not been prepared for it, and we feel completely out of our depth and very uncomfortable. So I think I was very fortunate, but hopefully what I've managed to do in this book is to share the ideas and things at the end of every chapter in the book is what I call a consider this section, which is how do you put these ideas into practice, regardless of whether you're just starting out in your business life, whether you're middle management or whether you're the CEO. And, you know, we can get these ideas into action. So, as I say, I hope I've shared what I've learned.
That's one of the things I love about your book, is that at the end, in each chapter, it has a recap, it has a reflection moment. So it's pause, let's think about and reflect upon what we've learned, and then application. If you are in this role, like learning to fly, the metaphors around aircraft are all throughout the book, obviously, but learning to fly, here's the things that you need to do. And then all the way up the continuum to, if you are at the senior, most senior roles, this is how it applies to you. So the book really is written for anyone who is in leadership or desires to be in leadership.
Well, I like to think so. You know, the premise of the book is that it's inevitable, Chris, that we hand over control. You know, as a CEO, we'll retire. As a team leader, we'll move on. Or heck, as a parent, our kids grow up and leave home and start to lead their own lives. So it's inevitable that we hand over control at some stage. Leading from the jump seat is all about how do we lead with the intention of preparing others to carry forward those things that are important to us after we have stepped back. And when we lead from that place, it creates an entirely different dynamic within our teams and our organizations, because leadership then is not about retaining or growing our own power. It's about empowering others. It's about creating the space where we can lift others up so they can lead when we have taken that step back and are no longer their leader. That's what it's all about.
I realize that I've done a disservice to the listeners so far, is that they may not be familiar with what the jump seat is on the flight deck. And the title of your book is Leading from the Jump Seat. Sure. So for the non-pilot or the people that aren't familiar with aviation, can you tell them what the jump seat is and exactly what it is and what it is not in the flight deck?
I will. And very quickly, the story that prompted that title, you know, the jump seat on an aircraft, on large passenger jets, you will have the two pilot seats, the captain, the first officer, or the co-pilot. But then immediately behind, you very often have what's called the jump seat. And this seat is usually empty. But, you know, crew members who are catching a ride home, they can sit there. You're so close to the pilots, you can reach out and touch them on the shoulders. You know, you're that close. And the title of the book was prompted by an experience I had in 2002, where I just certified a brand new captain, a guy called Callum. He had been a first officer for some years. He'd gone through about 6 months of training to convert over to a captain. I'd certified him by flying with him several sectors, and we just landed in San Francisco. And I said, great job, Callum, all yours. We're going to stop the night tonight, but you're fully certified. In the morning, you'll have a regular crew. I'll be down the back with the other passengers. And that was a great moment. The following morning, he came to me and said, look, can you come and sit on the jump seat? Because it's very busy out of San Francisco during rush hour. I'd love an extra pair of eyes on the flight deck to watch out for other aircraft as we taxi to the runway. I thought it was a very courageous thing to do. It just got me off his back, you know, after being checked for months. But he had the safety of the aircraft foremost in his mind. So I sat on that jump seat, strapped in, and we taxied out. And it was our turn to take off. We thundered down the runway, and we got airborne. And around about 300 feet above the ground, which is very close to the ground, we had an emergency. And what I then chose to do in the next 2 seconds would dictate whether I and the other 140 people on board would survive or not. But here's the thing. Spoiler alert. I did absolutely nothing. I put my hands in my lap and sat there calmly. The reason is I'd certified this guy to fly this aircraft as captain anywhere in the world. I had no business interfering. But more than that, I knew he had what it took to sort it out. And in that moment, I didn't need to be a leader. I needed to be a great follower. I needed Callum to feel that I had his back, so he then could be all he needed to be to get us out of that situation. I'm talking to you here now, so clearly it worked out okay. But if you want to know the rest of the story, it's all in black and white in the book. But
by the book, yeah.
Yeah.
Or by the book, right.
But that's leading from the jump seat. At some stage, the best thing we can do is to become a great follower.
You talk about in the book about having standards and that, so in moments of fear, you automatically know what to do. It's instinctual. And pilots trained to that, whether it's civil aviation, military aviation, they train in simulators. They run through scenarios in real life, and they're constantly focused on that. And I have to imagine that folks can't appreciate that in that moment of fear, your instincts took over and said, I'm not the captain. I don't have a control stick. I don't have, pedals. I don't have thrusters. I don't have anything. So the best thing I can do is let this trained professional that I've invested in do what they've been trained to do. And I think folks could take a lesson of leadership of that, is that if you've done the work and trained properly and trust your people, the results that you will get are expected. And that when you add another variable of your unplanned self into that situation, and on the ground, it can't be a catastrophe as bad as it can be in the air, but doing nothing is a strategy. It is trust.
Absolutely. And it's an essential strategy. You know, there's several things that you mentioned there, Chris, we could pick up on, but it didn't even cross my mind to take over control. But, you know, it wasn't as if Callum was just a guy off the street. I had a great relationship with him. I knew him. I knew the training. We'd given him the training. That's important. We'd equipped him to deal with that situation. We just needed to let him get on with it. Now, the flight deck of an aircraft for me is a microcosm of leadership, you know. And whilst our listeners might not be pilots themselves, you may have been on that jump seat, metaphorically speaking. You know, maybe you're a head of sales in an organization and you've got a junior sales guy who knows what he's doing, but it's his first big gig, his first big sale. It is so tempting to reach over and take control. So tempting. Why? Because your livelihood, your status, your reputation is on the line, perhaps. And so fear kicks in. Okay. But if we've trained that individual and we've got that trust, we need to back off and allow them to do their job. And sometimes, you know, they might make mistakes. And the way we handle that situation, well, we can create an opportunity to spiral up or to spiral down. Spiral down is where you prick that guy's balloon of confidence, and that can take months, if not years, to rebuild. But seeing it as an opportunity to spiral up, to help them learn from their mistake, that is the one I'm always looking out for in those situations. And we have a choice. And it's whether we are source ourselves from a place of fear or from a place of love and in service of the person on our team. So, yeah, the flight deck in an aircraft is a great metaphor. I've seen great leadership and poor leadership. But we have that opportunity always to choose the spiral up opportunity, spiral up moment.
Well, you've had an incredible career, and you've led in a lot of different places, and you've followed in a lot of different places. So you've had these experiences. I imagine that along the way, you probably have a leadership pet peeve or something you frequently see being applied or done wrong. Can you share with us your observations?
If I was to pick one, I'd probably go with what I hear a lot in leadership teams when I first speak with them. They'll say, why aren't they doing XYZ, XYZ? They being often the people on the team. You know, why is it that they don't do as they're told, or they don't follow the procedures, or they don't show up in a great way? And of course, the answer is, who am I being that's causing those around me to be who they are? In other words, the answer to that question is right there in the mirror. Because in my experience, it's the leadership team, it's how they are occurring to people that is causing others to show up in the way they're showing up. So if we want other people to show up differently, then ask ourselves, who am I being that is causing those around me to be who they are?
I don't want to give away anything in the book here, so keep me honest, but I imagine that in your learnings, there's probably something that you've considered the most important thing that you've learned in your career journey so far. Can you share with us kind of what that moment is or what that ideal is?
Can I share two?
Absolutely. Please.
Yeah. So one of them, or one and a half, because I've already mentioned one of them, which is be yourself. You know, that relates back to the story of me taking over the squadron and trying to be my predecessor. I was given that advice of be yourself when I was going through officer training many, many years ago. And I didn't fully realize what it meant at the time. Over the years, I've realized how important that is. You know, be yourself, be true to yourself, understand what's really important to you, and use those stands as a handrail to guide you when you're in unknown situations. That's so important. The other aspect that I'd like to mention is allowing things to happen rather than a focus all the time on causing things to happen. And I say that with a military background because when I was in the military, quite often we're in the business of causing things to happen. You know, I remember peace support operations or humanitarian relief. We're going in, you know, and helping and supporting, and that's causing things to happen. What I've learned since is the value of allowing things to happen. And what I mean by that is through who we're being, through what we stand for, our consistency, our character, sharing our vision of where we're going, we create a space into which others can step and they don't need to be forced. And when we allow things to happen, it turns out in my experience that quite often those things become much more longer lasting, much more significant, and much more fulfilling.
Great answers. And I love the metaphor again, giving up control. When you allow things to happen, it allows you to perceive from a different view. You're able to see everything rather than focusing on what you're trying to cause. It's the law of attraction. Like if you put your stand in the right place and you take your stand on the right things, then the right things will approach you, and the wrong things will, by the laws of nature, avoid you from that standpoint.
Yeah, actually, you're right.
So, Peter, there's probably a young junior leader here listening to the podcast right now. If you had a piece of advice that you would like to offer him or her about leadership, what would that advice be?
it's got to be starting with yourself. And what I mean by that is take the time to start figuring out what's really important to you. And the place to start there, Chris, is by looking at the choices that you've made in your life. You know, to give you an example, when I chose to go to university, I chose to study two subjects about which I knew nothing. I had no background, computing and electronic engineering. And the reason that I chose those was because I thought at the time, this was 40 years ago, this would give me the best opportunity of getting a well-paid job. And that was important to me because my parents had lost both their jobs. We didn't have much money at all. And I didn't want to be a financial burden on them. And so that became something that's really important to me, not being a burden on others, being able to support others. But then halfway through my university course, something else happened. The Falkland Islands, a British territory, was invaded. And it was nothing to do with the politics for me. I was just incensed that someone was imposing their will on others. And that just didn't feel right to me. So I left my university course and joined the Royal Air Force because I wanted to be part of a team that could do something about that in the future to help people who could not help themselves. And that choice identified to me something else that's really important to me, which is the notion of mutual respect. So there are two things that my choices pointed towards. One is not being a financial burden on others and being able to support others. And the other, the notion of mutual respect. And these are key stands in my life that help, well, it's part of my reservoir of energy that helps move me forward when times are tough. Yeah. So the best thing we can do, and it doesn't have to be just when we're young, at any time, pause and reflect, look at the choices that we've made and draw from that what it is that's really important to us, because that will serve us well way into the future.
Peter, what piece of advice would you give to someone with more experience in leadership further along in their journey, the journeyman professional? Maybe it's even a piece of advice that somebody offered you recently.
Well, I'll go with my gut here. Again, Chris, I would say pause and reflect on fear and love. And notice when fear is triggered inside of you, when it's triggered by a feeling that your livelihood, your status, or your reputation is under threat. And instead of acting on that fear, choose instead to see it as a warning flag and find the courage to source yourself from a place of love for something instead. And that looks like keeping your mind open to be in service of others, lifting others up, having humble confidence instead of ego, and seeing the world as a place of opportunity and possibility rather than scarcity. So in summary, notice when fear comes onto our shoulder and can take control and choose love instead.
Excellent advice. Do you have a favorite book, author, or mentor that you would recommend to our listeners? I ask this because you've written an incredible book on your own. You've also co-authored an incredible book with Simon Sinek. So I imagine that your bookshelf is quite requisite with some pretty incredible titles. Can you choose one and share it with us?
Well, I'm going to go with what I'm reading at the moment. I'm just bending it down to pick it up. It's written by a friend of mine, Rich Deviney, and it's called The Attributes, and it came out earlier this year. Rich is a former, well, he's a retired U.S. Navy SEAL. He commanded SEAL Team 6, amongst others. And this book on the attributes, it's a wonderful deep dive into what we're naturally good at, what leads to our skills. And I'm only a short way into it so far, but it's a good read. Lots of great stories in there, and I'm looking forward to getting much more out of this book as I work through it. So that's my recommendation for the time being, The Attributes by Rich Deviney.
Yeah, that's great. I love that you picked a book from another sector of the global military machine that people don't realize. They think in Hollywood, they think, fighter pilots or aviators, and then Navy SEALs, they have these tremendous egos, and they're this, it's glamorous and everything. But in reality, it's a lot of focus on repetition and process and standard and being humble. And sometimes going thousands of miles in the world to just do nothing and just to observe and to see and to detect where you can help, but not feeling like you need to do something. So the fact that you picked a book from someone else in that community, it helps to shatter the Hollywood stereotypes that go with our military men and women.
I think that's an important point. I mentioned in my book the Top Gun image, but I tell you, to have the Maverick sort of character on my wing, it's not the sort of guy I want there, because he's mainly focused on himself, which was one of the themes, of course, of the original Top Gun movie back in the 80s, wasn't it? But ego doesn't have a place in the cockpit. It really does not. And it doesn't have a place in any form of leadership. Not if we want to progress well as a team.
So you and I both know that magic wands don't exist. And I say this to a gentleman who is a native of the country that gave us Harry Potter, but magic wands don't exist. But if they did, and you had an opportunity to wave that wand at anything in the world and fix anything, what would you wave it at and why?
I think I would wave my wand in such a way that it gave people the courage to look at the positions they're taking against things in the world, turn that coin over, and discover the underlying stand, their underlying commitment for something. And it takes just a little bit of self-reflection to do that. But when people do it, it opens up a whole new realm of possibilities, and the energy it creates is way more powerful than any position against anything. So that's literally off the top of my head, Chris, but that's at the forefront of my mind, because we hear so much people taking positions against things in the world at the moment. Let's turn that puppy over and look at what the underlying stand is, because that's a better place to be.
Peter, had an incredible conversation today with you. I appreciate you sharing your time. How can people connect with you if they want to learn more about what you do, if they have a question for you about something we talked about, or if they want to pick up a copy of your book?
Well, thank you. You can find me on the internet, of course. My website is leadingfromthejumpseat.com, so same as the title of the book. I'm on most social media channels, so you can find me there. And the book is available widely. I'm sure you'll put a link in the show notes, Chris, but all the usual places, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, whatever. It's print form, paperback, hardback, audiobook, ebook. However you like to consume this material, you should find an option for you.
Well, folks, the book is Leading from the Jump Seat, How to Create Extraordinary Opportunities by Handing Over Control. The author is Peter Docker. Peter, thank you for your time today, and I hope we can have you back in the future.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's been an absolute pleasure. Look forward to speaking again soon.
I want to thank Peter for being a guest on the podcast today. Be sure to go to the show notes page at leanleadershippodcast.com and check out the links to learn more about Peter and how to connect with him if you have a question about what we talked about today. As always, I welcome your feedback on how to improve the podcast. If you like the podcast, be sure to go to podchaser.com, Lean Leadership Podcast, and leave a rating for the podcast or review. Thank you for listening, and until next time, seek progress over perfection.
Thanks for listening to the Lean Leadership Podcast with Chris Burnham. Get more info, resources, tools, or connect at leanleadershippodcast.com.